Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does the meat we eat get from the farm to our tables, and what sort of precautions are taken to ensure the safety of the food supply? When my guest this hour got curious about those questions, he took a job as a USDA inspector at a gigantic beef processing plant in Schuyler, Nebraska. The facility slaughters more than 5,000 cattle every day, each of which is inspected for potential contamination at multiple points before and after it is butchered. Ted Conover is distinguished writer-in-residence at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at NYU. He shares his experiences in his article, The Way of All Flesh, Undercover in an Industrial Slaughterhouse, which is the cover story for the May issue of Harper's Magazine. Ted, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
So you sought out this job with the intention of writing this story. What were you hoping to learn from the experience of going undercover that you couldn't discover as any kind of outside observer?
I think if you are an outside observer, you don't know what it feels like to be cutting into meat 8 hours a day, which beef inspectors do. You don't understand the ingenuity of the machinery and the careful attention it takes to stay alert for 8 hours on an assembly line. You don't have quite the connection to the meat itself that you get from handling it warm and seeing the cattle before they go in and thinking about what you're going to eat for dinner that night. All of that becomes rather immediate and real when you're working in a place like that.
We should say that the plant where you worked has one of those livestock ramps designed by Temple Grandin to sort of comfort the cattle in their last moments, but there's little doubt that they're still terrified.
It's an interesting question. She actually wrote me after she read the opening of my article in which a Mexican meat worker, a Cargill employee, tells me that it smells so bad because the cattle are afraid. He says they don't want to die. And that seems kind of intuitively obvious, right? No animal wants to die. And yet Grandin said that from the brief description of the cattle I offered, it was her conclusion that these cattle were not upset, that they were not thinking about their imminent demise. And I'll tell you the truth, I don't know. I think her ramps are an improvement over whatever came before, but the fact of the matter is these cattle, every few seconds, you know, get a captive bolt placed inside their skull and slowly die while their hearts keep beating out the blood that that the slaughterhouse needs to get rid of before the pieces of their body can be disassembled. So it's a violent thing, and it's something to treat with a lot of respect. And of course, it's something that we need to work hard to minimize the animal's suffering in. But bottom line, we kill them. That's what they are there for.
Mm-hmm. Did you find a sense of respect for these animals among the workers that you met?
I'd say so. My familiarity with our industrial slaughtering process mostly came from hidden videos that all of us have probably seen, you know, produced by groups like Mercy for Animals or the Humane Society of the United States, in which workers get jobs like I did inside a slaughterhouse, but unlike me, do it for the purpose of capturing abuse of animals. The animals at this plant are they're outside. I worked on the kill floor, which is this gigantic room about the size of a football field, an area where the animal is killed, but you can't see it being killed. It's sort of behind a wall. And it then makes its way around on this slow-moving chain, and there's at least a couple hundred people in there. So it's sort of a moot point whether animals are being abused in there. The animal is dead, and where people have captured abusive cattle, it's usually been on dairy farms or occasionally in a feedlot, rarely on the range, where they grow up eating grass and spend most of their lives. So this wasn't a case like that. I was mostly interested in the process of these bodies becoming meat.
So what's the arrangement by which USDA inspectors are sort of permanently assigned to individual plants and then present for every shift?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a system that started up right after Upton Sinclair published The Jungle. The government was so shocked by what he described, even though it was a novel. It had a very strong basis in reality about rats in there and all kinds of impurities entering meat in these factories, that federal inspection began. And the law requires inspectors to be on site for any slaughter facility to operate. So Cargill, which ran this particular plant, had to make room for us to have locker rooms, a meeting room, in which we could eat lunch. We had parking places. We have special badges that get us into the factory, and they can't look in our lunch bags like they can their own employees. So it's kind of interesting. You really are embedded in this large corporate environment. And one of the things I went in wondering is whether, you know, that would lead to inspectors getting a little too cozy with this company they're supposed to monitor.
Is there, does that coziness exist, or is there a sort of cultural tension between the Cargill workers and the inspectors?
It's really interesting. They tend to know each other because this is small town America. A lot of them have worked in the same factories before. A lot of them grew up together. But there was definitely a strong ethic there of, we're here working for the American people. We're not here working for Cargill. I was told several times, you see anything wrong, hit that red button. And that red button stops the line. I mean, it idles a lot of people. And after working there a very brief time, I was entitled to hit the button. And I think I did 3 or 4 times while I was there. And it's pretty exciting. And the supervisors back you up. And I can imagine if there was an inspector who is really button happy, that word would come down from on high that this needs to be reined in. But they weren't shy about stopping the whole process when they saw something go wrong. And in my experience, that included things like lubricants. Oil would drip down sometimes from the track above, and it would you'd see it dripping down the side of a carcass of meat, or on the stainless steel viscera table that we stood at for many hours of the day, cutting open livers and hearts. Sometimes we'd see drops of oil, dark oil on there. We stopped the line for that. Guy I was working with saw a Cargill worker drop a liver onto the floor and pick it up and rinse it, but his hands were still dirty. Mm-hmm. And he pushed the button for that and had an argument with the Cargill supervisor. But we tend to win those arguments. And our chief, a veterinarian, if something's really bad, sends a special report to Washington, and then the slaughterhouse has to respond to it. So it's a pretty interesting system. I saw it up close, and so in a way I'm knowledgeable about the real personal level. But if you're going to ask, is inspection sufficient at the grinding plants where hamburgers made? You know, that's where a lot of contamination gets in. That's kind of a different branch of things that I know about less well.
Yeah. And we should say that at this point in this country, meat contamination is not the biggest source of foodborne illness.
It's slowly been eclipsed by contamination from produce and other kinds of food, which are the domain of the FDA. Confusingly, the USDA inspects live slaughter, poultry, pork, beef, and the FDA inspects seafood, produce, processed foods of all kinds. So it's this sort of split, and it's a little bit antiquated. There's still you know, in certain areas of beef slaughter, critics have said there's a little too much emphasis on these visual and tactile inspections that we still do, and not enough on microbiological tests that'll show whether there's some E. coli in that tenderized or the ground beef. So everything is the government is working to get up to speed on modern times, but it's a little bit behind, especially with the sequester. That's definitely slowed everything down.
Ted Conover is with us. He wrote the cover story for the current issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called The Way of All Flesh, Undercover in an Industrial Slaughterhouse. He's distinguished writer in residence at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We're going to take a quick break now as I am joined in the studio by Jeff Whittington, executive producer of Think, host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. What a great conversation. I mean, you know, we cover food from so many different angles on this show, and I think it's really important, and our audience wants to know these stories, and I appreciate Ted being with us today, and this is a great conversation. If you appreciate these kinds of in-depth conversations, talks with journalists on the show that we do on Think, and we do talk to Harper's contributors quite frequently on the show, because the journalism there is just so great. Well, this is your opportunity right now to support the station and support the show. And today's a really important day, Chris. We have a huge challenge on the table this hour.
That's right. $1,000 challenge from Mary Lou and Will Smith when we hear from 50 callers with donations. That's up to you, Think listeners. We have 47 left to go. We can receive an additional $1,000 just for this hour of Think if you can help us out. Please do that now by going to 1-888-694-6931 or go to kera.org online. Make your contribution. Let us know you love Think, that you make this part of your day, and that you support great public radio in your community.
Check out the reusable shopping bags with the KERA logo on the website at kera.org. Those are available as a thank you gift. The reusable mug is available as well. We're giving you the opportunity to make your membership a green membership, which means that we won't send you mail. We'll just send you emails and communicate with you through email and electronically. Honestly, it saves the station money when you join the station that way, when you choose a green membership. But we're happy to give you any thank you gift that you'd like. And I personally would really support your use of a Think mug or a KERA mug or the reusable shopping bags rather than paper coffee cups or, you know, the paper or plastic shopping bags. Really support that. Plus, you know, it's really cool when I'm at the store and I see somebody with a KERA t-shirt on. I always tell them that I really like their shirt. I just say, hey, I really like your shirt or your shopping bag is really cool, because it is. And, you know, we all want to do our part for the environment and we all want to do our part for our food supply. So it's a great conversation, and this is your opportunity to support it.
Support the station now by going online to kera.org, where you can check out thank you gifts and help us with your contribution to receive this $1,000 challenge thank you gift from Mary Lou and Will Smith. You can also make your gift online at 1-888-694-6931. It just takes a couple of minutes of your time. You will be supporting not only Think, not only a locally produced program, but also the great expansion that we have provided for you in local journalism here, plus all the great programs that come to us from PRI, APM, NPR, around the country and, in fact, around the world.
888-694-6931 is the phone number. Again, 1-888-694-6931, or click and join. Do it right now, please, while we're in this challenge period, online at kera.org. Looking for 50 contributions this hour, 47 still to go. Please be the next one to call.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ted Conover. He is Distinguished Writer in Residence at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at NYU and author of the cover story for the May issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called The Way of All Flesh, Undercover in an Industrial Slaughterhouse. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You know, you mentioned, Ted, that one of the things you couldn't have fully appreciated without going there yourself and doing this work. But I have to say, I didn't recognize how physically demanding these jobs were for inspectors.
I don't think I did either before I got involved in this. And if you're a poultry inspector or pork inspector, it's not the same. Beef, you have to do a lot of cutting. You have to cut into pieces of the animal, especially to open up lymph nodes, because lymph nodes tell a story about illness. And if you find problems with a lymph node, it often means there's a problem elsewhere in the animal. So we all wore scabbards from our waist with two different kinds of knives, one for livers and one for the heads, tongues, hearts, and lungs. We had a meat hook, just like workers do, to hold the meat steady when it's hanging from the chain. Really, the hardest part of this job for me was using that knife, learning how to do it in a way that didn't just leave me in agony at the end of the day and didn't leave me behind all the other inspectors, most of whom have been doing this for years. I mean, it's a demanding job.
So with the inspectors and the line workers as well, I was surprised that the problem is not so much the injuries we might imagine, like a lot of knife cuts, but what you describe as deep bloodless injuries.
Right. So it happened to me. Gosh, it was my second week. I woke up in the middle of the night with pain in my forearm, and I thought, that's weird. I wonder if I was sleeping on it the wrong way, but it just got worse in nights after that. And a coworker, I was sort of complaining about it openly, which people there don't do. And she said, "Hey, have you tried wearing a brace at night?" And she said, "It really helps with carpal tunnel." And I said, "Well, I don't think I have carpal tunnel. This is just my second week." And she said, "Oh, I think you do." And she was the expert. She'd already had two surgeries, and she'd recently gotten an injection in her carpal tunnel that got rid of the pain in like 3.5 of her fingers, but it didn't affect the nerve that affects the outside of the ring finger and the pinky. And so those were more pronounced, and she felt that it hadn't solved her problem at all. Anyway, my supervisor had scars on his arm. My trainer takes 3 Advils every day before work and every day right after. They have a lot of pain, and they don't talk about it because that's just not the way they are. It's a lot of repetitive stress, and I was almost loath to complain about it because the regular meat workers have it worse. They don't get to change their post like we did. You know, we work in 5 different posts that rotate during the day. They mostly stick with the same one, do the same thing over and over again with fewer breaks than we had. So, you know, if I figure what I had is sort of a fraction of what they do, there's a lot of pain that goes into the meat, and I think no way around it. You know, machines can do some of this work of cutting up a big animal, but it's people who do most of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Mike in Fort Worth. Hi, Mike.
How you doing?
Great, thank you.
I'm glad I finally got through to you guys. I just had a comment. He said earlier that he did not know that much about the ground beef industry, and I used to be an employee at a place that ground meat. It was mostly beef at the time, but the comment I wanted to make is they have metal detectors to catch, you know, like bearings that have come apart, pollutants, you know, such as that. But what I did notice in working there, that the meat comes in frozen boxes, and then they send it through giant microwaves to thaw it, and then they grind it. And I've seen a lot of instruments, tools, like they use PVC shovels and hoes and stuff to move the meat around. That way, if they get caught in the grinder, it doesn't tear up the grinder or doesn't cause, you know, injury. But as far as I know, there's no device that after the meat's ground, if it gets polluted by PVC, that it's detectable.
That's very interesting. I know one thing that you found, Ted, and that other people told you about was that I guess cattle will eat all kinds of stuff and it ends up in their stomachs.
Yeah, I thought that was the kind of contamination that the caller was referring to, some metal from the factory that had gotten into the animal. But in fact, when I saw this big wire sticking up out of the stomach on the viscera table, my trainer said, oh, no. That part of the stomach is like their garbage pail, and cattle eat anything, and that's why we feel that part of the rumen when it comes through. We want to make sure it doesn't get further than us. And so there were just, you know, I was there less than 2 months, but we found long pieces of wire sticking out, screws, nails, fasteners of other kinds. So a lot of that contamination comes in the cat, you know, the animal before it's ever slaughtered. It's not introduced by the company at all, and the company has to find good ways to get rid of it. It's complicated, and there's a lot of attention that needs to be paid to make sure it's done well.
So if you working at the viscera table, which is an expression I never thought I would have cause to use on the air, if you're working at the viscera table and say you find something concerning in the liver of a particular animal, is it easy to flag the rest of that steer to remove all of that meat from the line, or is only the liver a problem?
So normally it's a small thing like a liver fluke, which is sort of like a big paramecium, half an inch long, green with little cilia around its edges, just like in high school biology, and those come in because the cattle drank contaminated water. That gets what we call it. We stamp it once with a USDA condemned stamp. So people won't eat that liver, but animals still can. Your cat can still eat that liver, and that's a sort of slight problem. A bigger problem is a liver that has a bunch of abscesses in it, and those get stamped twice and are not to be consumed. Normally, they don't. Neither of those cases implicates the meat from that same animal. It's not like tuberculosis, which you know, you would find throughout the organism. It's sort of a localized problem. So there's a judgment call that inspectors are taught to make between the sort of routine infections and imperfections that you want to, you know, note so certain parts don't make it into the food supply, and then something big that would mean you have to go take out that whole carcass. And each carcass is numbered. In fact, that's how you watch the day go by. If you're on the morning shift, it starts at 1, and after lunch, you know, you're getting up to the mid-2000s, and since they slaughter just over 5,000 a day there and there's two shifts, you can kind of count the minutes till you get out by the number of the animal. And if you find a bad infection in the head, the number on the head corresponds to the number on the carcass, and they can go track down the carcass and rail it out and do tests on it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Ellen who says, I appreciate Mr. Conover's work, but I'm curious about the journalism ethics of going undercover and misrepresenting oneself to report a story. Why don't you tell us about how you did that, Ted?
You bet, and that's a good question. I did this for a book called New Jack, Guarding Sing Sing, in which I became a New York State correction officer and worked at that prison for almost a year. And I think of this as sort of the nuclear option in reporting. It is something to do only when there's no other way to get the story. when the story is really important enough to justify the deception you'll need to use, and when you can protect the privacy of sort of people who are innocent of anything but having, you know, had to work with you, who shouldn't suffer at all from that. So I take it very seriously, a thing like this. And I think, as with prisons, meat is something that is kept, you know, the creation of it is very carefully kept out of sight. And I guess that's because it's upsetting for a lot of us to see animals killed and to see blood. But it's what it is, and it's really important these days because of all that is done to meat between the time, you know, an animal is born and the time we put a piece of it onto a fork and put it in our mouths. Things can happen to that meat which aren't wholesome. And the process, I've always felt, should be transparent. There's no reason to treat this like a state secret, how an animal gets processed. And yes, I could have gotten a tour. Cargill has said several times since my piece came out, why didn't he just give a tour? We give tours all the time. And not all companies do, but it's true that they do. But as I said, there's some things you can only learn, I think, by doing day after day after day, and even week after week after week. And a guided tour is not going to teach you the same thing. So that's sort of a long answer, but it's a very important question, and I don't do this sort of thing lightly. I didn't lie when I applied to get this job. I used my legal name, which is not Ted, but Ted was down as a nickname. I didn't lie about working for NYU. They are listed as my employer. I truly thought there's only a 50-50 chance I'll ever get this job because they just have to do some poking around and they'll figure me out. But I think, I guess when you're vetting meat inspectors, that's not what you're worried about. You're wondering about their credit history or their criminal past, or did they pass that test for carpal tunnel, which is another thing that I think will keep you out of there.
Ted Conover is my guest. He is, in fact, distinguished writer in residence at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at NYU and author of the cover story for the May issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called The Way of All Flesh, Undercover in an Industrial Slaughterhouse. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes and invite you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Executive producer Whittington has joined us now back in the studio. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. We are working on a $1,000 challenge this hour from Mary Lou and Will Smith. When we hear from 50 callers or online contributors with a contribution in any amount, we'll get KERA will get an additional $1,000 from Mary Lou and Will Smith. Big supporters of the station. Very generous challenge. Please be the next one to call 888-694-6931 or go online to KERA.org. Chris, everybody does this when it's membership week. Everybody says, well, we'll do it. I'll do it later. Really, acting right now is so crucial because we all want to wrap up this drive as soon as possible. We're going for a 7-day drive. We're looking now, hopefully, maybe to finish on Friday, trying to make up some ground today. And that's where this challenge comes in. And that's where you come in. Your contribution right now is crucial to ending this membership campaign successfully and as soon as possible.
Maybe it is for you like it is for me picking up my dry cleaning. For some reason, I just think, oh, I'll get to it later, whatever. And then I do it, and it takes about 1 minute. I'm in and out. I feel so much better. I've got clean clothes. KERA, pick up the dry cleaning for KERA or of KERA. I don't know.
I just get one shirt at a time on my way to work. I'll get the rest later.
It's too heavy. Anyway, it really is an easy thing to do. And the wonderful thing is you don't have to, you know, your membership lasts for a year. So, and if you set up a sustaining membership where you do, you know, 10 or 20 or 5 or 50 or whatever dollars per month, that's like set it and forget it, Ron Popeil style. You are done. You can just not worry anymore because your membership will remain current.
Should we be making slicing and dicing references this hour, Chris? I mean, I'm not sure.
I think that was accidental on my part, but thank you for calling me on that.
42 contributions left to go to make this 50 donation goal for the hour. Don't forget Mary Lou and Will Smith, supporters of the station, are going to give KERA an extra $1,000 if we hear from 50 of you during the hour right now. This is one of those territories that I think people are interested in hearing and maybe don't want to miss part of the conversation. Well, that's why we're doing the membership break right now, Chris, is to give people a chance to not hear from our distinguished guest and just to hear from us, reminding you of why KERA is important to you and that there are conversations here and interviews here that you don't hear anywhere else. That's what you're supporting when you call 888-694-6931 or when you click and contribute online at kera.org.
Well, we have heard from Mary Sue Foster in Dallas. Thank you, Mary Sue. David Sunshine in Dallas and Renata Margolis in Dallas. Really appreciate all those contributions, and we would love to read your name as well if you want us to. If you want to remain anonymous on the air, that's fine as well. But we would really appreciate hearing from you now. 1-888-694-6931 is the number, or you can go to kera.org. We have this challenge grant going. We need 50 donations in this hour to get this additional $1,000. We have 40 to go, so we would love to be able to pick up the pace here. This is a lot of money for us, and of course, Will Smith and we've received this challenge grant.
Mary
because
Lou and Will Smith.
Mary Lou, thank you. I wanted to say Mary Sue because we had a Mary Sue and I knew that was wrong. Mary Lou, excuse me. They want to make this money work for them and work for KERA, and so that's why they put this challenge on the table. We want to make all this money, the challenge grant, as well as the money that you can contribute, work for you. So we ask that you make a contribution now.
Well, it's a very generous gift, obviously, and they're Mary Lou and Will Smith are leveraging this contribution to inspire you to give as well. And that's really great. I mean, it goes, their contribution and their generosity goes twice as far. Your contribution goes further because you're giving during a challenge. So do your part right now. Call 888-694-6931 or click and contribute online at kera.org. It's really important we hear from you today. We'd like to wrap up this membership drive as soon as possible, but hey, we can't do it until we hear from you.
Your contribution allows us to continue to bring you great guests like Ted Conover, like Augustine Burroughs in the next hour, like all the people that you hear on Think every single day. It allows us to bring you the podcast, to produce local journalism, and it allows us to bring you the national shows that you never want to miss. So please make your contribution now at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. Back in just a minute with Ted Conover.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Ted Conover, who wrote the cover story for the current issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called The Way of All Flesh, Undercover in an Industrial Slaughterhouse. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Ted, I'm curious, based on what we were talking about before the break, about your take on the so-called ag gag bills that are looking to ban the presence of cameras brought in from outside to industrial meat plants. What do you think?
So just as I was applying for this job, the first of the ag gag bills was heading for passage in Iowa. And when I read about it, I thought, oh, that'll never pass. No one will try to outlaw the act of taking a picture in the United States. But that's what's happened in, I think, 6 states so far, taking pictures or video without authorization around an agricultural production facility is now a serious crime in these states. And of course, these are aimed at the activists who have used this kind of visual information to such good effect with YouTube and others. And their whole goal has been to show animals being abused on their way to becoming food. And, you know, that wasn't my exact agenda, and I wasn't planning, I don't own a hidden camera, I just try and get out there myself. So I was thinking this probably won't affect me, but it turns out the one Arkansas is considering right now would affect me. It would affect any, quote, unauthorized investigation and has this idea that, you know, only police should look into problems like this. And so I see this as a sort of attempt by the meat industry and sympathetic legislators to kill the messenger. Before I ever expressed a preference to the government about where I'd like to be stationed, I asked Nathan Runkle, the founder of Mercy for Animals, how they chose their plants. I said, did you like go after ones that are notorious? He said, no. He said, we it's hard enough to get hired, so we'll just go wherever we can get hired. And he said, we've never failed to find abuse. It's always just a question of recording it. So that was kind of sobering. And gave me sort of a dark vision of the way animals are treated in the Midwest. And then I'm in the break room at the USDA inspector's facility in Schuyler, Nebraska, and we're reading about the latest video that shows abuse of dairy cows that are up in, I think they're in Idaho, and the workers are hitting them with plastic canes and trying to make them walk when they have broken legs and kicking them, and it's pretty bad, and the inspectors all gathered around a computer to watch, and they were disgusted and outraged, and so I think it's not at all true that most people think some abuse of animals is okay. I think what happens is these big companies have a management that is sort of officially against abuse, but can't be bothered to watch for it down on the ground level, and so abuse happens because these are low-paid jobs and you know, unhappy people, and they're taking it out on the animals sometimes. So anyway, I have strong feelings that these laws are a bad mistake, and I was worried about them every step of the way.
And yet there were, I guess, security cameras all over the plant. Do you know what sort of activity they were there to monitor or maybe to prevent?
Really good question. I was told that they were not there to look at government employees. They were there to look at the company's own employees, and the company had a way, in fact, of watching this video at its headquarters in Kansas, which is kind of, all kind of creepy. And but I think it's probably, for a number of reasons, if they suspected an employee of not acting safely, of sabotaging, they could watch that person. If that person were goofing off, maybe the cameras would let them know. I got to see the cameras, but I never got a good explanation of what they were for.
What did you learn about the use of antibiotics and pharmaceuticals in general in animals produced for meat?
Yeah, so there was a woman in a lab coat watching us as we made our cuts into livers, and my coworker told me she was from Eli Lilly, so I spoke with her. And Lilly makes something called Tylosin, which prevents abscesses in livers. Abscesses form when grass-fed cattle start being fed grain in a feedlot, and they get acid stomachs, ulcers, and then bacteria travels into their livers. Either she explained it poorly or I misunderstood. I thought she said there was a correlation between the use of antibiotics, like overuse of antibiotics, and these abscesses. I think that wasn't it, that she was there trying to figure out how to use these antibiotics more effectively. But just the fact that antibiotics are routinely fed to animals who are not sick, which is business as usual in the meat industry in the United States these days, is a big problem, especially with what they call subtherapeutic doses given to cattle as they grow. I've read, getting tetracycline, I think it is, can add 3% to an animal's weight, and that translates into money for farmers and meat companies, but it puts the rest of us who depend on that drug to get sick from bacterial infections at risk, because as we all know, when you use an antibiotic and you don't need it, it weakens the drug. And So the whole topic of antibiotics around meat is a really disturbing one. And, you know, other countries, Canada, a lot of Western European countries say you can't just do that. You can't just give all these animals drugs when they're not sick. And it's one of the things you can't see if you're an old-fashioned inspector using a knife in your hands to feel problems in the meat, but it might be there anyway.
So there's a lot in the article, Ted, that we haven't been able to cover this hour, so I do think people are well advised to read the whole thing themselves. But I do want to talk about the end of it, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure.
You said you hadn't eaten meat sort of from the day you started until about the time you were ready to leave. You do eat meat now, but talk about why you sort of felt the need for a while to stay away from it and how the experience has changed your approach to eating meat.
Yeah, so I've never been vegetarian, but seeing those steaming organs right after lunch, my first few days of work, just really turned my stomach, and I just felt I felt uncomfortable. 5,000 animals a day is a lot, and it seemed to me one day sort of like predation gone crazy, that a small number of humans were killing this number of animals. So I just stopped. I ate a little bit of chicken and wasn't going to eat any more meat. And then the day I'm about to leave town, my inspector friend says, "Hey, before you go, let's go get a T-bone. I know this great place, 1995, and we'll bring the wife and." And I, of course, I said yes, because all inspectors, it seems to me, still eat meat. Even ones who've worked in hot dog factories still seem to eat hot dogs. And I thought I'd give it a try, but I did not know until the minute I brought that steak to my mouth what would happen when I tried to eat it. Mm-hmm. I thought it's going to go one of two ways, and I didn't know, and I waited till they had started eating, and then I took my bite, and it was so delicious. I know this isn't the end of the story everyone would want me to have, but I'm just being honest. I missed meat. I still eat it. I was raised on it, but now I think about it more carefully. I think about everything that goes into it. I try to avoid the kinds of meat that are going to be less healthy for me, and I try to eat a little less.
Ted Conover is Distinguished Writer in Residence at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at NYU. He wrote the cover story for the May issue of Harper's. It's called The Way of All Flesh, Undercover in an Industrial Slaughterhouse. Ted, it's a fascinating piece of work. I really appreciate you making the time for the conversation. Thank you.
I feel the same about you making the time. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thanks to all of you today who are listening to the conversation. We really appreciate you being with us today and every day on Think. We appreciate those of you listening to the podcast. And we really want to give a shout out to those of you who are making contributions to keep the station strong and healthy. Your donation right now at KERA.org is a vote in support of quality journalism, of public radio that matters, that covers everything under the sun. We are looking, in order to make this challenge goal of $1,000, for a total of 50 contributions in this hour of Think. We have 35 to go. There are easily, you know, hundreds of times that many listening right now to Think who are not yet members of the station. If you could just step up and be the one person who says, absolutely, this matters to me, make a contribution now in any amount, and we can receive this $1,000 challenge generously offered by Mary Lou and Will Smith. Jeff Whittington is back in studio now. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. The number to call, 888-694-6931, 888-694-6931. I want to thank Kathy Walensky in Fort Worth, Cynthia Nichols in Grand Prairie, and Jan Trabig in Arlington. I want to thank Emma Rogers in Dallas, Marilyn Koshin in North Richland Hills, and Myra Weeks in Wichita Falls. They've either contributed online at kera.org or they've called 888-694-6931. 6931.
You know what I loved about the conversation with Ted and about his article in Harper's and our ability to bring it to you? He's so down the line. He reports what he sees, his observations. He doesn't go in with an agenda one way or another. I think the conversation and certainly the article, they give you a really balanced perspective. He found some great stuff and some things to give you confidence. He found some things to give you pause and leaves it up to you to make a decision about whether this affects your life or your choices, the same way that we endeavor to do every single day on this show and really throughout the program schedule here on KERA.
And, you know, Chris, this is just one conversation in a long line of food-related conversations that we are having on the show all the time. We had Michael Moss on a couple of weeks ago.
Michael Pollan's on tomorrow.
Michael Pollan will be on tomorrow. We'll have Temple Grandin on the show next week, who designed the ramp in the slaughterhouse that Ted Conover reported from.
I might just ask her about her call to Ted Conover after
right.
the story
well,
came
and,
out.
And we'll have Daniel Vaughn. For those of you who are worried that we sound anti-meat on the air, we'll have Daniel Vaughn, the new Texas Monthly Magazine barbecue editor.
Who has beautiful new book out.
A new book coming out. He'll be in studio on May 21st. So this is just part of the constant food coverage that we bring you on Think, talking with food writers and talking about nutrition and talking about the environment in which our food is grown. And we hope that you like that. We hope that you'll support it by calling us, 888-694-6931. Make a contribution. We've got this challenge from Mary Lou and Will Smith. It's $1,000 to encourage you to be one of the 50 contributors we need this hour. We're still waiting to hear from you online at KERA.org or on the phone at 888-694-6931.
What we love about you as an audience for Think is how you sort of come with us every day on a little journey to find something out. And we love that you know, no matter what we're covering, whether it is science or politics or ethics or food or popular culture or art, you're with us. You come with an open mind and ready to sort of explore and just to understand how some person has arrived at his or her conclusions about something. We work really hard to make sure that our guests are people who are well qualified to talk about what they've learned and to share their knowledge. And then your openness to this, your eagerness to learn is really part of what makes the show so special. But the show could not exist, even with all that great energy out there, it could not exist without your financial support, because there are salaries to pay, there are expenses associated with putting it on the air. You can keep this on the air by going online to KERA.org or call 1-888-694-6931. KERA, of course, is the only North Texas public radio station.
The only news and information
radio station. Of course, because we have our sister station, KXT.
Down the hall, that's a public radio station.
They're still here and they're fine.
But yeah, this is the only place that you find this kind of show in the North Texas area. It's the only one. And you know, we talked to a lot of people from around the country, from around the region on the show. And, you know, every decision we make is based on you. What is being talked about out there? You know, these state legislature bills about, reporting or activism in the meat processing and in farming. It was making news a couple of weeks ago, and then this story came out in Harper's, and this is obviously a hot topic right now. And food issues are always a hot topic among our public radio audience. And you know what? Farming's a hot topic, too, and we talk about that on the show, too. So please make your contribution. You know, there are lots of radio stations and lots of choices for you out there. Just like there are lots of food choices for you, there are lots of media choices, but you've chosen to listen to KERA, and now we're asking you to support it. There's only one station like this, and you found it, so please come on in, take one more step, call 888-694-6931, support the station, you're going to feel really great that you did it, or click and join, do it online at kera.org.
Would it be easier if we could raise all the money we needed by selling commercial time and not having to come to you directly? Maybe. But I would argue we might have a lot less freedom to spend the time to cover subjects in the depth that you've come to expect from us, mm-hmm. that allow you to recognize how different public radio is, how different KERA is from other choices on the dial. Part of that is a factor of the fact that we work for you. You pay the expenses here with your contributions at KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931. You're really a journalistic philanthropist, if you think about that, when you make a contribution.
Absolutely. That's what it's all about. The station only answers to you. And we're perfectly happy asking you just a couple of times a year to support the work that KERA does on your behalf. That's what this is all about. And it's membership week, and if your membership is up for renewal or you've never been a member before, take this opportunity right now and support KERA by calling 888-694-6931. There's some friendly folks waiting to take your call down the hall right now. The number to reach them and to take care of this is 888-694-6931.
Thanks.